The next case before the court is Nexteel Company Limited versus U.S. Case number 211334. It's an appeal from the Court of International Trade. Okay, so I understand that the way we're going to do this is that Mr. Baleen and Mr. Josen, is that how you pronounce it, are going to argue first, or Ms. Josen?
Your Honor, Ms. Josen represents the Department of Justice for the United States. So
okay.
She'll be arguing, I guess, in the very end.
At the end. Okay, and to the response as it relates. Okay, the cross appeal. All right, and Mr. Allman and Mr. Winton, I'm just going to put you all on separate clocks. So when your time's up, your time's up. I'm not keeping track of your splitting. So the clock will tell you when you have to cede your time. Okay. So Mr. Baleen?
It's Beeline, Your Honor. Sorry.
Beeline.
Like I just made to the podium.
Yeah, you're missing an extra E in
there. I'll blame my ancestors.
You can take your mask off if you're comfortable doing that. Yeah. It's easier for us to hear.
Sure, Your Honor. Thank you, Judge Bryson. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. For the record, my name is Thomas Beeline with the law firm Cassie Levy Kent on behalf of United States Steel Corporation. A bicameral and bipartisan Congress passed into law in 2015, the particular market situation provision. This was intended to give the U.S. Department of Commerce the quote-unquote queen on the chessboard when it came to adjusting costs in the anti-dumping calculation. And so in the case at bar, this was one of the first cases that Commerce had before it, substantial record evidence that established that a particular market situation existed in Korea, and Commerce made adjustments to the constructed value of respondents to calculate their dumping margin. So what happened and why are we here? We're here because, as the first panel was describing, the substantial record evidence standard was misapplied by the Court of International Trade. Specifically, the court did not defer to Commerce's reasoned interpretation of the substantial evidence before it. In fact, Commerce had 6,200 pages in the form of evidence of articles, industry publications, Government of Korea documents, official import statistics, which all established that the particular market situation in Korea impacted the cost of producing oil country tubular goods.
Well, I'm trying to determine to what extent this is just a factual dispute and to what extent there is a debate over how the statute is to be interpreted.
So, Your Honor, primarily before the court is a substantial evidence question because the respondents here, my colleagues, did not appeal the Court of International Trade's legal finding that Commerce's interpretation of the statute, which, by the way, is entitled to Chevron deference, which the court applied here, where the Court of International Trade said that the totality of the evidence framework was appropriate and Commerce did not explicitly need to tie any distortions to the cost of producing oil country tubular goods by these particular respondents. So that, I don't think, is before the court. I think that that's a distraction. Rather, what's before the court is that the Court of International Trade did not give credence to all of Commerce's reasons for finding a particular market situation. In fact, there's a large number of pieces of evidence that the Court of International Trade never addressed, even though Commerce specifically referenced those pieces of evidence. What should have happened here is what the Supreme Court counseled in Florida Power and Light, which was the court should have said, I don't find these issues or these pieces of evidence compelling to your conclusion, Commerce. Go back and explain further or explain why I'm not understanding them correctly.
I mean, the court did that once, right? And Commerce took a second shot at it and it came back up and the CIT said, no, that's still not good at it, again, and then that's when I take it the CIT directed that you shouldn't do this. And the problem, and I mean, I see some appeal in that. I mean, I don't think the CIT should be able to do that. But the problem I have here is it does not seem that Commerce objected to that and wanted a third try at justifying the particular market situation. And so what do we do with that? Because do you have a right as a domestic producer to force Commerce to try to justify its reasoning for a third try? Or is that their discretion? And should we, I mean, we can ask this from the government when they get up here, but isn't that their call as to whether they want to try on a third remand or not to justify that?
So, Your Honor, I think what you have here is evidence in the remand determination where Commerce has put a footnote that they often do in situations where they disagree with the court. They cite to this court's opinion in Barrage.
Sure.
And so I think that that's a signal to the court that it is unhappy with the situation that it's been put in, but it does not find that it has discretion when it's a directed verdict here because Commerce...
No. But I mean, the government well knows that they have the discretion. And if they wanted to, they could have made enough fuss and either said, no, you're wrong, we're going to try it again, or we'll do the directed verdict, but we think we have the right to try it again, and here's our third try. Or even if they didn't want to annoy the CIT by trying it a third time, they could have said, we're doing what you say, and then appealed here. They didn't do any of those things, though. They did what the CIT said to do, and they haven't appealed, which is a lot like cases where the CIT knocks them down after the first couple of remands and they say, we give up and, you know, we'll live with it, and then don't appeal that. And that seems, it's a little odd because of the directed verdict instead of the CIT just doing what it should have done, which is send it back down and letting Commerce have the discretion. But given that Commerce didn't appeal that, I'm just a little curious as to what relief we can give you. At best, aren't we going to send it back to the CIT and say you shouldn't have directed this? You should give Commerce the opportunity to do it again if they want.
I'm glad you asked, Your Honor, because our request for relief is actually this court has the ability on de novo review.
No, but I'm not interested in that. What I want to know is if we're not going to do a new de novo review for you on substantial evidence,
understood,
which I'm not inclined to do on the first instance, even though we can do it, is the result going to be, CIT, you shouldn't have directed the verdict here. Let Commerce tell you whether they want a third remand or not. And what is Commerce going to say? I guess they'll say, but if they say, no, we don't want a third remand, you don't have any independent right to force them to do a third remand, do you?
I could appeal Commerce's decision not to have based its determination on substantial evidence, right? I have a stack of papers that says that Commerce's determination is supported. Okay. On the other side, there just is no evidence to suggest that there's no particular market situation in Korea. So what I'm saying,
but that's what you're already appealing,
right? But if Commerce made a determination, a reasoned determination. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I interrupted you.
No, okay. What you're saying is if Commerce declines to do a third remand, you can say that decision is not supported by substantial evidence, and its original decision was supported by substantial evidence. But you're already here saying its original, or at least its second remand determination. So then we would just be reviewing a almost completely discretionary act of whether they're going to undertake a third remand.
Well, so, Your Honor, not to peel back the curtain at all, but while this appeal was pending, Commerce continued to find particular market situations in Korea, and they continue to have directed verdicts by the Court of International Trade. So where we are is in a situation where Commerce feels like they are boxed in on remand. They do not feel like that with the Article 3 judge telling them you cannot find a particular market situation, that they have discretion to find a particular market situation. So what they've done is they've released what is essentially a bare-bones remand redetermination that has no evidentiary basis at all to say we're complying.
Okay, I get it. But if they disagreed with that, and like I said, don't want to annoy the CIT by ignoring it, they still could appeal to us and say, stop doing that.
I wish they would
have. But they didn't.
I wish they would have, Your Honor. It would have been nice to have them here appealing it, of course. But frankly, this is an issue that, you know, the Congress was identifying as a major issue for domestic producers of OCTG. And so we're here because we're picking up Congress's mantle at this point to say, you passed the law in 2015, President Obama signed it, first application of it, the Court of International Trade says you can't do it anymore. It's barely 5 years, and this is dead law at this point.
Well, did they say you can't do it, or they say you haven't provided sufficient evidence to invoke
the You haven't provided sufficient evidence, but we're not going to review the entirety of the record evidence before you. In fact, what is missing from this decision is a stack of papers that's about 10 tabs long of information that Commerce cited that was never addressed by the Court of International Trade. So the court did not even give Commerce a cogent reason as to why substantial swaths of the record were ignored. And that's just not a substantial evidence review, I don't think.
What do you think? There are a lot of weeds in this case. So let's get down to the weeds a little bit. Why do you think it was okay for Commerce to base its ultimate decision on the subsidies for HRC on an AFA finding in an entirely separate proceeding against POSCO?
It's a fair point, Your Honor. I think that what Commerce had before it was, what is the quantification of the adjustment? What should it be? What it had was a final determination of subsidization of POSCO. And what it had before it in the record evidence was information talking about the steel industry identifying restructuring as urgent. It had POSCO's CEO saying things like, we're struggling from China flooding the market with cheap products. We need government intervention. It had information that said that Chinese imports were placing downward pressure of a significant degree. And so
just on the subsidization of HRC issue.
I think it's
and the use of AFA at 60%, which is awfully high compared to what later was determined to be more like 0.5%.
I agree, Your Honor. It is obviously a wrinkle in this case, but I think that goes to the adjustment factor. And what we have here before you is actually not the adjustment itself, per se. We have the fact that the Court of International Trade didn't even get there because they said you can't find a particular market situation.
Well, so if the 60% is not reliable, doesn't that go to the question of whether there was a PMS at all?
Oh, I think it's completely reliable, Your Honor. I mean, it's
60% is AFAs are designed not to be reliable. They're designed to be punitive.
Well, no, Your Honor, respectfully, I'll disagree because the rate is not supposed to be punitive. It's supposed to encourage cooperation.
That's right. It's like the difference between specific deterrence and punitive.
That's fair, Your Honor. What I guess I'm trying to say is that Commerce had before it something to quantify the adjustment with. It had a number. It felt confident in that number. Whether there were other numbers that could have been used on the record, there certainly were, and those could have been argued about. And some people argued about them, and some people didn't. But what is here before, I think, this court is whether Commerce has supported its remand redetermination with substantial evidence. Did a particular market situation exist in Korea during the period of review? We say that it does. This court should affirm that. It should reverse the Court of International Trade's directed verdict. And if not, then send it back, as Judge Hsu said, send it back to Commerce and say, explain, you know, in longer sentences why these, you know, 10 documents that were never addressed by the Court of International Trade do support your finding. And if Commerce wants to reopen at that point and say, you know what, we heard Judge Bryson. Judge Bryson said that 60% seems like a very high adjustment rate. We'll make an adjustment. By the way, the record evidence that the Court of International Trade ignored shows about a 60% differential between what the Chinese prices were and what domestic Korean prices should have been. So it's not
when
so...
When you say Commerce kept doing this, and you did it in other cases, but Commerce kept referring back to this one, right?
Correct, Your Honor. This was the
so
first.
So to the extent, you know, garbage in, garbage out, to the extent there are flaws in this one, there are flaws in others down the line.
Respectfully, Judge O'Malley, there were flaws in the first administrative review, which was the very first time that Commerce applied the provision. And Commerce looked at it in a preliminary determination and looked at it in silos. They looked at four different factors and said, silo one, we can't find it. Silo two, we can't find it, et cetera. Then in the final determination, after receiving case and rebuttal briefs, Commerce said, all these things interact with one another. I see how it works. That makes sense. So they looked at the totality of the circumstances. Commerce explained that to everybody in the final determination, and the Court of International Trade directed a verdict in NR1 without even hearing the comments.
Well, the Court of International Trade said, in theory, the totality of the circumstances, I get it,
right.
And that's okay.
Right.
And said, I'll assume they can proceed on that assumption. But even with that, you know, you can't make the sum of the parts equal something that
sure.
individually they just don't add up to.
Sure, Your Honor. In this record, as we explained to the Court of International Trade during oral argument, the Court of International Trade found the argument waived, which was strange to us because the judge specifically asked what's the difference between this administrative record and the first administrative record. And we said there are 29 new documents, 5 documents where they've been substantially updated for this period of review. And those all go to all the different factors as to how things work together, where there's complete overlap. And the things that Commerce found that were lacking in the first administrative review preliminarily, that there was no cause and effect, there was a Government of Korea study done about restructuring the steel industry that identifies a cause and effect. And so to the extent that that wasn't existing in AR1 but does exist in the record of AR2, that should have been given credence by the court, and that was wholly ignored. And so what I'm saying to Your Honors is that administrative reviews are snapshots in time. I recognize my time is over, speaking of time. But those are snapshots in time, and the administrative record changes periodically. And so you may have one decision in one review that finds one thing and another decision in another. And that's to Your Honor's point about different CVD rates.
Okay.
So, Your Honor, thank you very much for the indulgence.
I'll give you your 2 minutes back.
Thank you.
Mr. Almond?
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Henry Allman from Arnold & Porter K. Scholler for the record here on behalf of Nexseal Company Limited. I'm going to be splitting my time today, well, our side's time with counsel for SAO, Mr. Winton.
What do we do about those 29 documents that were never considered?
Well, first off, I do think that they were considered. You know, the court gave Commerce a remand. Commerce looked at all of the evidence. And the court's analysis, when it looked back at Commerce's remand analysis, was that those 29 documents weren't enough to move the needle across the certain threshold. You know, we have to rewind to the history a little bit, which Mr. Beilein touched on as well. This all really started in the first administrative review. Petitioners made this allegation under the new statute, and Commerce deliberated on it for months. The allegation was there, they deliberated, and they issued a preliminary decision, a 19-page memo, step by step, saying each of the 4 factors, there was no evidence. And so the question really is whether those 29 new documents kind of change that analysis. You're starting with no evidence, and now do these 29 documents out of 6,200 pages, do these handful of new documents on the pile change things? And Commerce focused on a couple of those documents in particular. You know, there was articles about the steel industry in China and imports into Korea. And the court looked at Commerce's analysis and said, those materials are not compelling. That's not a reweighing of the evidence. That's taking a look at the documents and saying, this does not constitute substantial record evidence. It was evidence of surprise, there are imports from China into Korea. That's basically what a lot of those materials show.
But didn't Commerce find that the evidence showed that there was a distortion of production costs because of these factors?
That may be Commerce's conclusion, and that's a conclusion that we don't think is supported by substantial record evidence at all. The statute isn't just, does a particular market situation exist, you know, period or question mark, depending on how you phrase it. The question the statute poses is whether there is a PMS such that the respondent's costs are outside the ordinary course of trade. And we think that's the fundamental flaw in Commerce's overall analysis, is they don't get to that question. They take these 6,000 pages, a factor here, a factor there, but they don't tie them back to our costs. I mean, that's what the statute is trying to do. It's trying to calculate a constructed value based on our client's costs. And without assessing those costs, I don't see how Commerce can reach a conclusion that they're outside the ordinary course of trade. So You know, I think that covers some of the history of the case and why.
So how does that apply to the totality of circumstances test, which, at least for purposes of this, we seem to agree can apply? Commerce doesn't have to show exactly how a particular market situation impacts a certain input, right? They can look at all the various inputs and describe in at least some detail that the totality of circumstances are affecting the costs and do this adjustment, right?
And this is what Judge Togrove said, is yes, in theory you can.
Well, that's what I understand. And your position, even if you, maybe you want to dispute the totality of circumstances at all, let's just not get into that. Let's assume that applies. But the view here is that even if that's possible, all commerce has done is shown these four basic areas where there are some things going on that could lead to distortion of cost, but they're basically theories, and they've made no allegation to connect any of them up to an actual cost distortion.
That's right. And you know, going back to your initial phrasing of the question, you know, sort of what is the degree of specificity that commerce needs to find? I'm not going to sit here and say, or stand here and say, that commerce needs to, you know, put a fine needle on it to say the costs are X percent lower than they should have been. But commerce didn't do any of that. They didn't reach any determination.
So I guess that's what I want to ask, because it's a new statute. It's a very fuzzy kind of, you know, terminology and calculation anyway. What else would they need to do when they say, look, China's dumping hot rolled coiled steel. The Korean government subsidizes electricity. Just assume all these are true. I know you want to object to that. I just want to get to the hypothetical. And then the other two things I forget off the top of my head. You know, they say these are all these things that clearly can affect the markets or the cost inputs, because one input is the steel, one input is electricity. And based upon all these factors together, we think that the cost of productions here don't match up. And so we're going to make an adjustment. What do they need to do to make that connection beyond identifying these are the typical inputs and we think they're distorted?
I think number one, they have to somehow reference our actual data. They didn't do that whatsoever. Number two, they have to meaningfully consider the contradictory evidence we provided. For my client Nexsteel, we compared our costs to a whole series of benchmarks, and I get it, commerce, you know, they're very good at this. They disregarded them based on, you know, it's not perfect, this, that, and the other. Mr. Winton, for his client, Seiya, will tell you that they pointed to their purchases from Japan, and they have these confidential numbers in their brief that would show, you know, hey, look, if something's going on in Korea, let's get out of this allegedly infected market and find something outside of it. Let's see if this bears out in the data. Let's see if your costs are lower relative to something outside of that, you know, quote-unquote infected market. So we think that's what commerce needs to do at some level, you know.
Well, isn't the difficulty with the quantification, doesn't that go more toward what methodology commerce could use ultimately to address that, the misstep in the market, rather than to whether or not there's a PMS in the first place?
I think it's both. And our reading of the statute is that there's this phrase after the words particular market situation. It says a particular market situation such that the costs are outside the ordinary course of trade. So we think at some level they need to conduct an analysis of the costs to conclude that they're outside the ordinary course of trade. Going to the second question of whether that strictly goes...
Well, didn't they conclude that all of these things basically impacted or decreased production costs?
That's their conclusion, and that's the conclusion that we think is unsupported by evidence because there's no link to the costs. But as you say, you know, there is this, you know, adjustment factor question. And the adjustment factor they used completely undermines the whole story in that they're saying that there's these factors and here we're going to apply this huge adjustment to the costs. That, you know, in our view, is obviously unsupported by substantial evidence. The other side has gone to lengths to not include that in this appeal. The you know, lower court of international trade didn't expressly rule on it. But that's a whole separate issue, whether commerce could use this AFA calculation from another case as a plug for our company's data.
But what else did they have in the record to rely on? In your brief, you say, well, they should have looked to the subsequent 0.54 number, but that wasn't in the record, as I understand it, of the administrative review.
So is
that right?
I'll have 2 points on that. And
well,
you know,
first was, am I right in thinking it's not in the record? That's probably a yes or no.
I'll do something that I probably shouldn't do and say, yes, that's right, it's not in the record, with a caveat. And
okay,
that caveat is Commerce's remand was in November 2019. Throughout the remand, Commerce says, we're doing this analysis de novo. We're, you know, the court has thrown it back at us. We're going to take a big step back and look at everything. In the intervening time, in I believe June of 2019, Commerce had published that 0.5% rate. So whether it's in the record or not, it's a published decision.
But whatever the rate is, whether it's 60% or 0.5%, isn't it fair to say that subsidies relating to an input can distort the market?
It's fair to say that they can, but, and this is a big but, there's no evidence that those subsidies would have flowed through to our clients. This is a subsidy to an unaffiliated, well, there's been questions in the case previously whether the company was affiliated, but whether one company that receives a subsidy, be it 60% or 5%, are they going to pass that through in the form of lower costs? The whole point of a subsidy investigation is whether, you know, the respondent there benefits. If a respondent benefits to the tune of 60% or 0.5%, they're going to keep that in their own pocket. They're not going to just one-for-one lower their prices to their customers. So, yes, some benefit might pass down. There's no evidence here that any benefit did pass down.
Let me see if I understand what you said in response to my question about it wasn't in the record, but, and run that by me again, that it was already published. It was a published rate. When, at what point and in what proceeding was it published, the 0.54?
That's right. So the 0.54 and 0.2 is from the hot rolled coil CVD first review. So we've got the investigation, which was the 60%. And then, you know, these cases are proceeding, you know, in parallel. The hot rolled CVD first review was published in June of 2019. I believe I have my dates right. And Commerce issued its remand, the remand on appeal here in November. So Commerce is saying, we're doing this de novo review, but we're going to, you know, well, Commerce didn't ignore that decision. They said, looking at these two decisions, we think the investigation one is more probative because it's more timely or contemporaneous. As the Court of International Trade said, that's just patently wrong. So it's a decision that Commerce itself had published.
Okay, so what you're saying, I guess, to get to the chase, is that even though it wasn't part of the formal investigation record, it was something that Commerce had published, albeit in a different proceeding, but one was predicated on exactly the same facts and therefore should have been taken cognizance of in this investigation.
That's our position,
okay.
Yes.
Right.
Okay, I need to give Mr. Winton time.
All right, well, no further questions. Thank you, and I'll allow Mr. Winton to call.
Mr. Winton, are you limiting yourself just to the cross appeal, right?
I had intended to, but I thought I might talk
okay.
for if it's okay.
Okay, well, you've got 5 minutes.
I'll talk fast. Good afternoon, Jeffrey Winton on behalf of Sayo Steel Corporation. I want to just touch briefly on the discussion you just had. because I think there's a misunderstanding. The statute doesn't say, is the price of hot-rolled coil low? I'm sorry, was POSCO's cost of hot-rolled coil made lower? The question is whether our cost of hot-rolled coil reflected the cost of production of hot-rolled coil in the ordinary course of trade. That's a different question. In order to answer that question, you need to know what is the cost of production of coil in the ordinary course of trade. And there's no evidence on the record at all as to what that might be. So yes, as Henry said, maybe there's a PMS, maybe there's a not. But the statute says it's not the existence of a distortion. It's this distortion such that the cost of coil that we pay does not reflect the cost of production of coil in the ordinary course of trade. Subsidies to POSCO, I think Henry's addressed everything else. I did want to talk.
Well, I get that, but if the allegation is that China is dumping into Korea hot rolled coil that is below the cost of production.
There's no evidence for that.
Well, I understand, but this is the problem, is there's the theory, which seems what Commerce has come up with, and then I think what the CIT's problem is that they didn't connect that up to cost of production to you.
I would say it's different. The CIT didn't actually address what I just said to you. Right? CIT looked at this and said, you use the phrase totality of the circumstances like it's abracadabra. I got four empty glasses here, abracadabra, it's full. That's how they use totality of the circumstances. There's no actual analysis that these things work together in any way. There's nothing. It's just, we looked at four things, weren't enough.
I think you don't do yourself a service when you exaggerate in this way and pass off Commerce's analysis here as so frivolous. I mean, they come forth with at least four specific things that theoretically could impact and make a particular market situation. If the facts are borne out, those are sufficient. And so I think just brushing this aside and saying,
Your Honor,
don't interrupt me, please.
I'm sorry.
Right? But the question is how far you have to go in proving those. And I get it, the CIT said, you have just posited these theories and there's not enough to substantiate these theories. But this is very, very difficult economic stuff. The proof is often not there in records and stuff. You know, you do yourself a huge disfavor. You sat in the audience during your opponent's or your friend's side and shook your head vigorously one way or another. Now you are frowning at us and making faces. This is not the way to appear in an appellate bench.
Your Honor, I'm very sorry.
Can you just tell me what the level of particularity is required?
See, here's where I respectfully disagree.
No, I didn't. I'm not making a point to disagree or to agree.
No,
but I want to know from you, help me. What level?
Here's what happened. In the first review, Commerce looked at four factors and said none of them individually adds up to anything in the preliminary. In their final, without any further analysis, they simply said, but the totality of the circumstances.
That's not the question I ask you. I ask you is what level of particularity should have been made to substantiate that?
Well, what I'm saying is, in order to say the totality of the circumstances prove something, you need to show how these things work together. It isn't enough just to say, and really, you may dislike the way I'm arguing it and say I'm frivolous, but the reality is when you look at what Commerce said, they said there's a totality of the circumstances, we've got all these things, yeah, there may be something here, maybe something not here, the statement was made, it's really the same record as in the first review, the evidence is basically the same as in the first review, we make the same decision as in the first review, in the first review we said none of these four was sufficient on its own, but we looked at them and we said totality of the circumstances. But never explained how that was supposed to work. And to me, you may disagree with my characterization, but I think it's actually accurate that it's not sufficient to say, we looked at this in the whole, and we look at the whole and it's okay. You gotta explain why it's okay. You gotta explain why the subsidies, alleged subsidies, interact with these other things to cause the cost we pay not to reflect.
But you made that argument to the CIT that you wanted Commerce to be required to, before it ever confined a particular market situation, to apply the analysis on a company specific basis. And the CIT never made that finding.
Right. They didn't go either way.
But you're saying we're supposed to assume that you're right.
No, I'm not. Because it's not a question necessarily. You could say you don't need to show that SEIA's price for coil didn't reflect the cost of production. But if you're going to do it on a market-wide basis, then you have to show that the Korean market-wide price for coil didn't reflect the cost of production on the ordinary course of trade. We did not rely on this, that it's got to be company-specific. That argument was made by other parties. Our argument was, whatever it is, market-wide, company-specific, the statutory standard is whether it reflects the cost of production in the ordinary course of trade, the price, our specific price, the market-wide price, reflects the cost of production in the ordinary course of trade. And there is no evidence as to what the cost of production in the ordinary course of trade was, so you couldn't make that determination on a company-specific or a company-wide basis. But the Court of International Trade didn't rely on our argument. They didn't get to it. What they said was, we looked at these things, we looked at the evidence Commerce has cited, we asked them to explain why all of these things work together, because they said it was the totality of the circumstances, and they really didn't come up with anything. They didn't come up with anything. They didn't explain how these things fit together. They didn't explain how this created a distortion in the market.
You're way over your time, and I understand that we took you down some other roads, but I've given you extra time. So,
I'm very sorry, because I really did want to talk about one of our cross-appeal issues, but very seriously, judges, what you said to me, and I will try.
Which particular cross appeal did you want to talk
about? The issue of the freight revenue cap.
Of the what?
Freight revenue cap.
Okay. Do you, just so we can clean this up, do you agree that the differential pricing analysis issue, that because of our earlier decision in the Stupp case, that's off the table?
Stupp resolves it. Okay. Like Stupp says, there's nothing to say.
Okay.
On freight revenue cap, if I just may borrow a little time.
20 seconds.
Everybody agrees it's a straightforward question of statutory interpretation, but the disagreement is, what is the relevant statutory provision? If you look at the definition of export price and constructed export price, they say you start with the price at which the merchandise is first sold to the unaffiliated customer. That's the price you start with. The provision concerning freight adjustments then says, if that price, such price, includes freight, you can make an adjustment for freight costs.
Well, it only talks about reductions, right?
Right, but our point is, it doesn't, commerce, you're right, you can only deduct freight costs. The question is, if you say that the price of the merchandise doesn't include the freight revenue that you charge the customer, right? You sell the pipe for $1,000, you say, I'll deliver it to you for $50 more. Commerce says, no, the price of the merchandise is $1,000. Then the price of the merchandise does not include freight, and under 1677C, you can't make any adjustment for freight costs.
Okay.
And that's not what Commerce did.
We've got it. Thank you. All right, Mr. Beeling.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Tom Beeling again on rebuttal. So I think Your Honor spent some time talking about the statute with my friends across the aisle here. You know, what is really interesting to me is they kept talking about their costs. The constructed value provision has very little to do with those particular costs. It is constructed normal value. It is broad. It merely says the sum of the materials and fabrication plus selling general administrative expenses plus an element of profit. Why does it exist? It exists because we don't have home market sales to compare in the dumping calculation. So Commerce is directed by statute to come up with what the comparator ought to be. So it's constructed. In the constructed world, does Commerce use the costs as reported by the respondents? Sure, because it's the best information available on the record. But where there's information to call into question that those costs might be distorted by a particular market situation, which is a new provision of the law, Commerce is looking at that and evaluating whether there is an issue or not. And Commerce is entitled to deference on substantial evidence questions, deference that the Court of International Trade did not give, that this Court's opinions consistently counsel. And we come up here every now and then to have the substantial evidence framework reconfigured in a given case. This case is one of those to explain to the Court that deference to Commerce's reasoned determinations are appropriate. To Judge Bryson's question about the adjustment factor, that's a question that we can all argue about administratively. We can come back to this Court as to whether the specific factor is the right factor. But the question right now is whether a particular market situation exists. And so if there are no other questions for me, I will rest on that. Thank you, Your Honors. We appreciate the indulgence.
Okay, Ms. Johnson. Ms. Johnson, before you get into your argument, sure. I think Judge Bryson has a couple threshold questions that he's going to ask on behalf of all of us. Is that okay?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
I said Judge Bryson has some threshold questions he wants to ask on behalf of the panel.
Sure.
Yeah, you're in your brief, you ask for affirmance of the CIT's judgment. And what that led me to wonder is, are you taking the position that the CIT's analysis of the issues, including issues you have not addressed in your brief, was correct?
No, Your Honor. We actually are just, we haven't entered an appearance in the U.S.
Right. I understand that you haven't entered an appearance in the other case, but you're asking for affirmance of the judgment. There's one judgment, two appeals from the one judgment. So when you ask for an affirmance of the judgment, in effect you're saying, or at least it looks on its face to be saying, that the CIT's judgment and therefore its analysis is fine with you? Is that the position the government is taking?
Only with respect to the three issues that SEIA is
challenging. Okay, you're not really asking for an affirmance as such.
Not of the whole, no, we're just with respect to, and I'm sorry if that was confusing in our brief, but it's with respect to the issues that SEIA has challenged.
And what position is the government taking with respect to the issues that you haven't addressed?
We're not taking any issues with respect to those.
Any position?
No, we're not taking a position. Like the other issue that's before the court, we're not, you know, PMS issue, we are not taking a position with respect to that.
And with respect to the next appeal, you're not taking any position at all?
No, we're not, Your Honor.
So you didn't. I know you can't go into this, but usually when there's an adverse decision, the Justice Department consults with the agency and determines whether to appeal or not. And in this case, at least, and in the next case, you've decided not to appeal the Court of International Trade's treatment of the particular market situation issue.
That's right, Your Honor. We have decided
not to. You don't agree with it necessarily. You're not conceding that it was right, but you're just not appealing in this case.
We're not appealing, and we're not taking a position. That's right, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead. And I assume that you don't have to address the differential pricing analysis given the concession of
that's
the
right,
stuff.
Your Honor. We agree that stuff governs, and we would just respectfully ask that the court remanded for Commerce to further articulate its decision with respect to that one issue with the Cohen's D test.
Given your no appeal, though, of the particular market situation issue, what do we do with this directed verdict issue? Because normally I would think that you would disagree and appeal that, but since you haven't appealed that, even if we find what the CIT did was improper here and vacate and remand, how do you envision this going back when it goes back to the CIT? Because it's not really up, at least it seems to me that it's not up to the domestic producers to determine whether you're going to do another remand determination on the particular market situation. It's up to you. And if you wanted to do that, it seems like you would have appealed. I'm not asking you to predict everything, but it seems a little bit odd that we would send, because I think the directed verdict, the way the CIT is doing the directed verdict in these cases is improper. They should just find a lack of substantial evidence and send it back like they customarily do instead of directing a verdict. But if we agree with that, that's error, and send it back to the CIT, do you have any sense of what Commerce is going to do once it gets back to the CIT, given that you didn't appeal that?
I have no idea, Your Honor.
So you could foresee Commerce saying, we don't want to do a third remand, and so the results will just be sustained.
Again, I think it will be in the agency's discretion. I have no idea. You know, that's something I definitely cannot predict at all, on what would the agency do in that circumstance.
But it would seem a little bit odd if the agency wanted to do a third remand and didn't ask us to do one. Do you see what I'm saying? You chose not to appeal. I mean, I know how that process works. And you chose not to appeal. And so it seems a little odd to me. I guess what I'm asking is, and I don't know, because none of this was briefed, and this particularly a kind of technical way, is whether the error is either harmless or whether the domestic producer even has the authority to raise this legal error, because it's not really error that is theirs to raise, it's your procedural error. You can just say you don't want to answer that. This is all very complicated.
It is, and more sorry, minutes. I don't have a response to that.
There's only thing Mr. Winton got to on the cross appeal really was the cap on freight revenue. So why don't you focus there?
Sure. With respect to the freight revenue cap determination, that should be affirmed, and the reason is what Commerce did here was reasonable. It was supported by substantial evidence, and it was in accordance with law. The reason it was reasonable is when Commerce is coming up, when it does a fair comparison between normal value and the export price, or in this case, it's the constructed export price, when Commerce is making that fair comparison between those two prices, it makes certain adjustments to make the price, the U.S. price, at the ex-factory level, meaning that you're trying to get the price of the merchandise itself without any extra costs or anything else but just the price of the merchandise. And that's what Commerce did here. In accordance with the statute, Commerce deducted the freight costs that SEIA incurred, the actual freight costs that SEIA incurred. Commerce reduced the price, the U.S., the constructed export price, for that. And then what Commerce did was, for the revenue from the freight, and that's what the issue here is, SEIA charges its customer for freight, which is a service. It's not the good. It's not the merchandise. It's a service. SEIA charges its customer separately for that freight. So when SEIA gets revenue from that freight profit, Commerce caps it. Commerce equals the revenue that it puts into that, that it adds into that constructed export price. It caps it so it matches the actual amount that SEIA incurred. That's how you get the fair comparison. What SEIA is asking for here is, you know, include all of it. Include, even if it is a profit, but then what the construction export price would actually be is, potentially, it will be artificially inflated. It will be artificially higher than it should be, because you're putting in profit from the sale of a service, which is the freight.
Are you assuming that, to the extent that there's a, you know, a loss or a discount on the freight that's charged, that's otherwise built into the price of the merchandise?
No, what's happening is, if there's a loss, again, Commerce is only adding in the revenue from the freight to match what SEIA actually incurred. So this whole concept that SEIA is trying to argue that Commerce is doing it differently if there's a loss or there's a profit, Commerce is not. Commerce, at the end of the day, is doing what the statute is requiring and doing a fair comparison. Commerce is only allowing SEIA to include the revenue up to the amount it actually incurred. It's not letting it go
higher. What if there is a loss? What if SEIA is actually taking a loss, not making a profit on the freight or servicing the freight at cost, but in fact taking a loss? Why not adjust that?
Because that's not, that again, you're not getting a fair comparison. You're not getting to the X factory level of that. The customer is still paying that price. So you're putting...
Well, the point is the customer might be paying for something, but it's not necessarily the costs incurred by SEIA.
That's right, but that is still the U.S. price that the customer is paying. The customer is paying, even though it's paying it separately for the revenue, I mean for the freight service, that is still a part of the price that the customer is paying. So that's, bottom line, you're just trying to get at the price of the merchandise that the customer is paying and making it at the same level, at the ex-factory level, so it doesn't include anything else like, for example, profit from the sale of freight. And that's why the fair comparison, that's why it's the bigger picture here. Commerce is trying to make these adjustments so you get a fair comparison between normal value and the constructed export price so they match up. And that's how Commerce is, it's statutorily supported and it's reasonable what Commerce did here. And for that reason, we would ask this court respectfully to affirm Commerce's decision with respect to that, and also CV profit cap. If there's no questions regarding CV profit cap, I just rest on our brief in that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.